When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual-Samage from Guidehouse Insights.
I'm Rebecca Linen from Rebecca Drives with my cat Lucy.
What does Lucy think of the cars? Does she ever go for rides?
Lucy loves car rides.
Really?
She loves it. I put her in the front seat in her carrier buckled in, and then I have to open the sunroof and she will sit there and just stare out the windscreen. If it's cold out, she'll stare at the sunroof. Yes. Lucy is a car girl.
Huh? Usually cats are like suspicious. Usually they think they're going to the vet.
Cats are just naturally suspicious, period.
Yeah, her brother Linus was not a fan. I would give him some like kitty crack to calm him down in the car. But Lucy's all about it.
Our dog has that too. He's got like barbiturates or something when he's going to go to the groomer.
It's great. It's Box Pet Remedy. Yeah. It's all natural. It's really fantastic stuff.
Daisy loves going in the car.
Yeah, I was kind of eyeing him one day when I got a little cranked up. I was like, maybe I should just crush those up and snort him, calm myself down. No, I don't recommend it.
All right.
So a couple
we're way off track already.
Right. So a couple of housekeeping things before we start. So we now have a Patreon, which some of you have already found. So I wanted to make
and
sure.
And we love you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
I wanted to make sure that we thank those patrons. It does actually help. So let's see. Robert Grace, Colin Howe, Holger Eilhard. I hope I didn't screw that one up. Steven, no last name. Florian Herzog and Sean Whitehurst. So far, you guys are early adopters or early pledgers or whatever. You're one of the first. So we got some more things coming with that.
What
the support?
Why don't we explain what Patreon is exactly?
So Patreon is a way you can go and support your favorite creators, which clearly Wheel Bearings are a group of your favorite creators creating a thing. And so you can go to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. And there you can see our rudimentary page, which will get fleshed out with some more things, because one of the things it allows us to do is say at this pledge level or that pledge level, you know, increasing pledge levels, you can get exclusives or special things, some kind of little return for your support. Like a NPR,
you know, like PBS gives you, you know, tote bags and we'll give you something else.
Right. You know, we've got a couple of other things in the works that this actually helps support. So one of the things that I've wanted to do for a while is do a regular newsletter, an email newsletter. So we're getting set up for that. That's coming. We'll mostly sort of encapsulate some of the things that we talk about, but it gives you an easy way to read the things that we talk about. You know, often when we're talking on the podcast, we mention something that we've written or something that we've read or whatever. It's a way for us to sort of collate all those and send them to you automatically versus you having to listen through and make notes in case we missed anything in the podcast notes. So it's just another way you can get some more Wheel Bearings in your inbox. And then the other thing that we're working on that hasn't really shown up yet but may is advertising. So advertising can go a couple of different ways. There's programmatic, which everybody has a little less control over. That's basically you select your demographics and you know, we accept a deal. We don't really, it's not live reads or anything. It's basically we create some holes in the show and the platforms fill the holes with ads. The other way is just straight up direct campaigns where some of you who I know are on Apple devices with high household income, because we see the metrics. Some of you may control marketing budgets or have influence over it. If you would like to hear us talk about your thing, drop us a line, feedback@wheelbearings.media. And so from there,
and we'll talk about your thing.
Right, we'll talk about your thing. You know, it's a way I would dearly love to stay independent, and so this is a way that we can try to do that. Lots of money is washing into the podcasting industry after 20 years of being a joke. Now all of a sudden, everybody from iHeartMedia to Spotify has discovered it, and they're all pumped up with VC money and credit lines so they can pay for really great content. But the flip side of that for a creator is that you as the creator don't necessarily own your thing. You don't have as much control over it. And I'm a control freak, so I don't want to work for a giant corporation. I want to have a pretty direct line between us and the listeners. And so this will help us do that. So I'm going to step down off my sort of shop steward soapbox. Now we can talk about cars that we're driving, and we've got a pretty good crop. I would love to start with you, Rebecca, and your story of trying to get the Volkswagen Atlas Cross Sport to understand you.
Yes. Well, and thank you for all your efforts. We really are very grateful for the listeners, but it is a lot of work. And I think that's content creation is something that hasn't been as valued as it should have been from the very beginning. So anyway, so I had the 2020 Volkswagen Atlas Cross Sport. There's a couple of interesting things about this vehicle. This is a 5-passenger version of the Atlas, which is historically a 3-row large, it's a big crossover. But this one only has 2 rows, and then it has kind of this cool sloped back. So the 3-row Atlas is a little bit more square in the back. This is a little bit more sporty profile along the lines of the Audi Q7 and Q8. It's kind of the same idea. And what was very interesting about this is the day that it was delivered, it was a beautiful day. And I thought, I'm going to do something that I never do and always should, and that's take pictures as soon as I get the car, because usually I'm taking pictures like 5 minutes before Drive Shop is going to show
you too, huh?
Well, I always try to do that the day the car is delivered, because then it's still clean.
I know
to wash it again.
Exactly.
I just take pictures of dirty cars.
So I drove to the local beach, and there was actually a family there that had the 3-row. And so the mom and I were chatting, and because the kids ran off, actually the little boy came over to check out my car then too. But we were comparing, and one of the things that I noticed in the 2-row is that it's not significantly smaller. So you have this gigantic back cargo area.
Well, I think it's the same overall length.
It is. And so you have this gigantic back cargo. And what's cool about that is that if you don't need that 3rd row, you can then, you know, fit so much stuff, whether it's a giant dog carrier or if you just bring a lot of stuff with you. The woman was, she was super nice. And she did say that she only had 2 kids. She doesn't use the 3rd row, folds it flat most of the time, but it's there if they need it, which I can appreciate. But if you're somebody like me that's single or maybe has one other person, it's just not something that I would ever really do. And I like the fastback sort of look of the Cross Sport better. So it was a really good alternative. I was really happy with how big and how spacious this was. And it didn't drive particularly large. It was fun to drive. It was very engaging. I think I had said before about the Q7 that I had recently that it wasn't quite as emotionally engaging as I would like. The Atlas Cross Sport certainly was. It kind of was that, again, there was that Q8 sort of feel to it. So I'm driving along, and listeners know that, you know, I am the worst kind of early adopter because technology hates me, but I love it. And it's like this awful, like that, like elf in, you know, where he just wants to follow his dad around and his dad doesn't want anything to do with him. That's my relationship with technology. I am definitely the elf. I'm in the Atlas and it's got Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, all those good things. So I've got Android Auto activated and I wanted to go, I needed to find a local grocery store. So I put it in the local grocery store and it wouldn't give it to me. It actually said to me, speak softer. Now I'm Italian and if you need me to yell, I can yell. And I thought,
an Italian from the New York area.
From right? The New York area also. Okay, so if you want me to yell, I can yell out the window at you. So I was perplexed by this because I actually wasn't yelling at it was close. And
it didn't start
the bottom line was that it wouldn't it turned off. It basically said voice cancel. So a couple of days later, I'm with my brother Steve and we have to go to the post office. And I thought, Steve's a big Volkswagen fan. Actually, my first accident was in his probably mid-70s Volkswagen Bug. He was visiting from college, which means I was probably 12. And I got into his car and played, and I didn't know what the stick in the middle was for. And I couldn't remember it if when I got in the car, it was up or down, but I left it down and the car rolled down the driveway and hit a tree. We're sitting at the post office. We're at the old Greenwich post office. Yeah. And I said, you know what? I'm going to see if this infotainment system can get us to the post office because it just didn't, like it needed a specific address. We couldn't get the POIs to work. So I said, you know, let's take me to the nearest post office. And it said things like, be quiet, speak softer. And it said things like, I'm trying to remember now, but like it wanted information that I didn't have. It went into the telephone book. And so then I was like, okay, I'm going to go into navigation. And I don't know if we should have said, give us POIs. It was just strange to me that you can't say things like, take me to the nearest post office.
So,
and then, yes.
Does it have natural language processing? Like, is it supposed to be able to do that? Or because
no.
Steve also said like post office. And it was like,
because then we started making videotapes. Right. And so then we have three tapes of us talking and trying to get this thing to take us anywhere, really. At one point, it instead pulled up the name of probably the most famous person in India in my book, in my phone, in my contact book. Like it said, do you want to call this person? And I was like, oh my gosh.
So
no,
I mistook post office for Narendra Modi.
Yeah, I mean, it really was so incredibly random. And then, I used it without Android Auto. So it was just.
So that was all. That was with Android Auto.
That was with Android Auto.
Oh,
activated.
I see. So you were trying to get Android Auto, which should have natural language processing, right? It should have.
Yes. So the first time we did this was with Android Auto. The second time I disconnected Android Auto and had the exact same experience. We tried then to find the POI. So then we played with the system a little bit more and it shows the icon of the post office, but it won't actually, you can't actually like point to it, touch it. Like it just says you're near a post. You can't get to it. And it was perplexing. There were so many other good things about it. It was nothing like the Mazda CX-9 issues that I had. This actually could change the radio station and things, but just the navigation part of it, it didn't matter if I had Android Auto activated or if I did not, we couldn't get it to work.
One thing you might want to consider doing is going into your Google account settings. Because it saves when you use Google Assistant, it saves the voice clips, the audio clips in there for a while.
Okay.
And you might want to go in and just like go to that date and listen to the voice clips and see what they sound like. Because given that it was doing this with both Android Auto and with the embedded voice recognition system, I wonder if maybe there was an issue with the microphone or the audio system somehow in the vehicle that was mangling the sound of your voice, and that's what was confusing it.
It was very frustrating, obviously. It was funny in some ways. And again, we were parked outside the post office. I can't imagine trying to do this while I was driving, because I was trying to find something. And maybe I just am expecting things from it that it's not designed to do. So with Android Auto, do I have to do something to activate Google Assistant, or is that happening already?
Well, I mean, you'll see when you're in Android Auto, you know, if it's actually using Assistant, and on most vehicles, and we talked about this with the Mazda before, you know, on some vehicles like the Mazdas, when you press the voice button, it will just automatically trigger Assistant. In other cases, you do a long press on the voice button. So if you do a short press, a quick press on it, you know, then it'll trigger the embedded voice recognition.
Right.
And I can't remember what Volkswagen does. I've actually got a Crossport coming next week, but it may be that you have to do a long press to trigger Assistant. But you'll see if on the screen, you'll see the little thing, you'll see the little icon for the Google Assistant pop up, and you'll see it, the little waves in there, if it's using Assistant and the embedded voice recognition. Did you have the 2-liter or the V6?
So I had the V6. It's a 3.6 liter V6 engine, 8-speed automatic. Really liked it. You know, it was great power. This one, it was the SEL Premium R line, goes for about 52,000. So this is, you know, there's a broad range in this. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I think it starts around 30. So for the Cross Sport. So there's a lot of options that you can build up to. You know, it got pretty good fuel economy in that mid 20 range. I mean, low 20 range. I'm driving both on the highway and around town. It was quiet. You know, there was things that I really liked about it. And certainly, you know, I love the flexibility of so much room in the back. Again, I prefer that kind of more fastback sort of style to it. So if you need three rows, it's there. You know, the other version is there. But I liked the idea of kind of this sporty look and feel. And really, you know, just overall, I thought it was really good. Once again, like the Mazda, though, the infotainment system just really let me down, which is a shame because, like, the graphics are great on it. It's got this really cool, this Think Blue, and, you know, it'll show you your driving score, which mine was 93 out of 100. Thank you.
Wow.
And so it does, you know, I like the layout of it. There's quite a bit of black plastic in the black interior. And I would love to see Volkswagen either upgrade that or break that up a little bit with some open pore wood, a little bit softer feel, you know, like so many others have done, because it's just a lot of black plastic. But, you know, it's durable for sure. And you don't have to worry about it. You can wipe everything down. It had quite a small sunroof compared to other vehicles. I just finished with the Volvo XC60, and it's like the entire roof is a sunroof. It's amazing. The other thing is the front camera and the front bumper and front grille just below the big Volkswagen emblem, it sticks out about 2 inches. It's really odd. And it's like, it looks like such an afterthought. It's like, somebody went, oh crap, we forgot to put that in. Let's just stick it right there.
Dosh camera.
It just sticks out a lot. It was really odd because it was not integrated at all. Like, it literally looks like somebody went, oh, we forgot. So, you know, again, overall, I think that I certainly enjoyed driving it. You know, a lot of times when we have these different vehicles, you kind of look and think, oh gosh, I've got to go and drive that thing. With this, it was like, oh great, I get to go drive it. So it's a positive feeling from that standpoint. But, you know, again, I just think there are some improvements that can be made.
Well, you know, I think just like the big Atlas, the 3-row, Volkswagen has done a really good job making a Grand Cherokee with this. Yeah. Like, it just, every time I see one, it looks just like that was their benchmark for style, at least. And the cross sport looks a little bit more aggressive. You know, it's got bigger flares on it, or they just appear more prominent. And it does, like, the sporty profile, it looks sharp. There's not a whole lot of greenhouse. So how was visibility?
Visibility was actually surprisingly good. Yeah, I didn't really have any issues with that. I mean, I don't mind. Well, first of all, the whole cabin had a nice airy feel to it. So I could get into the driving position that I wanted comfortably. I could see, the visibility was good. The side mirrors, I would have liked to have had a little bit of a break between the A-pillar and the vehicle, how they have some of the manufacturers just, they almost like prop out the mirror a little bit, so you have a little bit of a view in between the mirror and the car. But that was only just occasionally. There's certain there's some specific turns that I need to make on the way to my sister's house that it's just a tricky, it's this kind of like almost like a hairpin left turn. And sometimes that it just gets in the way a little bit. But otherwise, you know, I certainly, again, I didn't have the types of issues that I had with the CX-9 where I couldn't get comfortable. The windshield is, because it's so sharply, dramatically sloped that the A-pillar often, it's like I hit my head practically. I didn't have those kinds of issues with the Atlas. So I think it was, overall, it was just a nice vehicle. I really enjoyed it.
And you had the instrument panel that's an LED, right?
Yes. Yeah, which was cool. Yeah. So, you know, the interior, the only issue that I had with the interior was just, I would like to see more variation in the black, in the materials of it. The graphics and everything were excellent. So from that standpoint, it was a very modern feel, you know, the digital cockpit that they've put in, again, kind of similar to what they've done with Audi, is really forward thinking. And from that standpoint, it's got a great look to it. It's just that voice thing will be really interesting to see if that's a problem.
If you can't get the stupid nav to work, you can't put the map in front of you.
Exactly.
But it's a good shot in the family crossover SUV market. You know, I think that Volkswagen really has pinned a lot of hopes on this. And I wonder,
well, I mean, the Atlas has been doing really well for them so far.
Well, I mean, it's a great product as a family buyer. Like if it had existed in 2013, when we bought our Jeep, I would have seriously considered it.
Well, it's a perfect Gen X. It's a Gen X brand, first of all.
Yeah, that's true.
And right. And, oh, you know what? Let me look. Oh, so the other thing too, in the center console in the front, there was actually room enough in there for my bag, which is like a small knapsack. But it fit really nicely in there, which I loved. The other thing, and I'm looking at the steering wheel right now, it does not have a hang up the phone button on the steering wheel. And that drives me crazy.
Kind of
I mean, there's a button to answer the phone, right?
No.
Really? Not at all?
Nope, there's
you have to
no
hit the touch screen?
You have to do the touch screen. There's no buttons related to the phone. It's probably, yeah, because I remember driving and having to reach over to answer and to hang up, which is a problem if the screen changes while you're on the phone. Because then you're flipping through. So yeah, because I'm looking at the screen right now, I'm looking at the steering wheel, and I remembered there was I thought this is the vehicle that I had that didn't have a hang-up button. And remember, I think it was a Honda did this as well, and then they ended up putting it back. So it might be the okay, the multifunctional okay button, like it is in the Volvo that I have right now, but it's I prefer a dedicated pick up and hang up buttons on the steering wheels. I think that's much safer than having a multifunction button that does it.
Nothing more to say? Shall we move on?
Nothing more to say, Alba. I'm done for the night.
Okay. All right, Sam, what do you got?
So I had the 2021 Toyota GR Supra. Finally got to drive the Supra, I liked it a lot.
Really? I can't imagine. Can't imagine why.
This is a great sports car.
Isn't it great looking? Everybody gives, like, I mean, not everybody, but you see the sort of like chatter that goes on about the way it looks and whatever. I don't know. Every time I see one in person, it's really striking. It's a really good looking car.
It is. I mean, you know, I think the fake vents in the front fenders and, you know, in front of the rear wheels, I think, you know, I would have preferred if they actually had, you know, air passing through them. But, you know, aside from that, the rest of it, you know, I think it's a great shape. I mean, it's a classic, you know, sports car proportions. You know, it's a two-seater, as a proper sports car should be, you know, with the cab way back, engine out front. It's rear-wheel drive. It shares its architecture with the BMW Z4. The reason Toyota was able to justify bringing the Supra back is they did a deal with BMW, and they collaborated on this architecture for the latest gen Z4 and the Supra. They share a lot of hardware underneath. They, you know, they share the same. They use the BMW powertrain, the 3-liter inline six. And for 2021, they also added a 2-liter turbo four cylinder as the base engine. The BMW 3-liter six is just such a wonderful engine. I've always loved BMW six cylinders. They're great engines. They sound great. It makes lots of power. For 2021, they upgraded the engine. Last year it was 335 horsepower and 365, I think, foot-pounds of torque. This year it's up to 382 horsepower and 368 foot-pounds. The base four-cylinder is 255 and 295. And from what I've heard from people who have driven the four-cylinder version, that one's also, I mean, I've driven, you know, that BMW 2-liter in a variety of vehicles, and, you know, it's a great engine as well. But the six is just, it's just lovely. It's a fantastic sports car engine. As somebody that, you know, I'm 5'11", one thing that was a little annoying is, you know, the way the roof line is shaped, you do have to duck your head down quite a bit. You know, the door opening is fairly small, and it's easy to whack your head on the top of the door opening as you're getting in and out. More so as I was getting in than getting out. But, you know, once you're in, you know, visibility actually is not as bad as you would think. You know, straight out the back, you know, there's a nice large window in the back, and, you know, to the sides and the front, you know, good visibility. The seats in this thing are fantastic. Lots of lateral support. They're very comfortable. Unfortunately, you cannot get a manual transmission in this thing. So only, the ZF 8-speed automatic, which is it's also a good transmission, but it's got paddle shifters. But I would love to try one of these with a manual gearbox in it. When you get in, you know, from the outside, you know, it looks nothing like a Z4. You know, the styling is completely distinct. Once you get inside, you see the BMW heritage. It's got iDrive. You know, the shapes of the dashboard and everything are very familiar, contemporary BMW. Nothing wrong with that. You know,
I mean, would you rather have iDrive or Entune?
Oh, no question at all.
Right? That's a great question.
I will take this, you know, 120 times out of 100. The graphics on the screen and the instrument cluster, you know, have been tweaked, you know, so it's got a little bit different look. Basically just reskinned the BMW systems, but it's the same system, which works well. You know, I've no complaints about it. The one I drove, was on these gorgeous 19-inch 10-spoke wheels, really fantastic looking wheels. The Supra has a nice big hatch in the back, so the cargo area is fairly shallow, but you do have this large opening there, so it's easy to put stuff in and out, and you can actually. It's got pass through straight to the passenger compartment. There's a cargo cover, you know, to hide stuff away, So it's not a huge trunk, but it's reasonably sized for a sports car. And, you know, I took this thing out and just went out and drove for a few hours out in the countryside and just had a ball with this thing. It was so much fun to drive. It starts for 2021.
Sam, would you ever put snow tires on something like this for the wintertime?
Yeah, I would. Because, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to have it as my only vehicle in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it's cold or there's light snow on the ground, I would absolutely put snow tires on it and drive it in the wintertime. Obviously, the limited ground clearance, you know, if the snow's deep, you're not going to get anywhere, even if you've got the best tires in the world. So that's why, you know, I would not want to have it as my exclusive vehicle in the wintertime. But I would absolutely drive this thing year round with the right tires on it.
And are there plans? Has there ever been a convertible?
There has never been a super convertible in its history.
I was looking back at
and I doubt that they're going to do one.
I was going to say there was the Celica Sun Chaser, which was aftermarket, but
yes, and that's all we need to say about that one.
Yeah.
The sun chased it away.
it was ASC that built that, I think.
I think it was. It was either ASC or Cars and Concepts.
Yeah.
One of those two. They did all the convertible conversions in those days in the early mid 80s.
Yeah.
But the 2-liter Supra starts at 43,000. The 3-liter starts at 51. The one I drove with the sorted options, and it didn't have a lot of options on it. It had the driver assist package, which was about $2,000 or $1,200, at $425 for the Metro Yellow, or Nitro Yellow, sorry, Nitro Yellow, that's about it. And the bottom line price came to $57,145, including delivery. So, it's not cheap, but under $60,000. It's very competitive, with any other sports car, with this kind of performance level.
It's more.
Did you have the 891 edition or the 3.0 premium?
The 3.0 premium.
Yeah, there's not much to complain about with the Supra. Other than, I mean, you could argue that it really needs a manual, but I kind of think it doesn't really.
Well, I mean, who's buying it, right? Like, is this, I mean, do we know, do we have demographics on who's buying this at all?
I have not seen any.
Yeah. Well, cause it's what, it's a brand that, I mean, it's a nameplate that again, like Gen Xers like us are, we have fond memories of this, but does it resonate with younger buyers at all?
I think, the Supra name actually probably does resonate with some younger buyers who are fans of
Fast and Furious kind of thing.
Yeah, Fast and Furious.
Games. Yes. Yeah.
The old JDM GTRs. The previous generation, the fourth generation, and actually even the third generation Supras from the late 80s, early 90s. Are very popular among that crowd, that are into those JDM sports cars.
So it's really, I wish they had a manual then.
Yeah, I do too. But I mean, the reality is that, if they had a manual, they probably wouldn't sell.
Right.
They would probably be lucky to sell 1,000 of them a year.
Yeah.
And, it's hard. You can't justify the expense. It's amazing enough that, in this day and age, they built this car at all.
Right.
To justify putting a manual in it as well for such low volumes would just be really, really hard to do.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I think that's an interesting pattern with Toyota and their sports cars is there is no pure Toyota sports car. They partnered for the, it started as the FRS, but the 86, there's a lot of Subaru in it. And then this would not exist if it weren't for BMW. I don't know that that's a bad thing, but it does lead to some kind of snarky comments. I do wonder how distinct the Supra is versus the Z4.
Well, I haven't driven the current generation Z4, but you know, from what I've heard, it actually does feel fairly distinct. You know, once they developed the architecture, you know, BMW and Toyota engineers basically went their separate ways and did their own suspension tuning on it, on each one, and they do, from what I've heard, actually feel fairly distinct from each other.
And they don't, and it does. The Z4 is a convertible too.
Yeah, yeah, that is another, you know, that's another, you know, important distinction between the two. And it's, you know, the BMW is only a convertible, whereas this one is only a coupe.
Right. You know, we're going to see more of this kind of collaboration anyway. I mean, it's I think they've done a good job of personalizing it and customizing it for their brand. And that's the, you know, the most important part when you're doing these kinds of collaborations is what does the consumer see? And, you know, I think when we think about the Fiat, the 124, yeah. Right. You know, not as much. I mean, these two, the Z4 and the Supra, I think, they are two different animals, certainly from the outside and to the buyer. And I think if they share some, you know, technology that allows them to put these vehicles out there, then go for it. I think it's a good idea.
You know, let's put it this way. I would rather that, you know, automakers collaborate and share some components and be able to offer cars like this at all.
Right.
And to not have them, you know, even if there is, you know, more in common between these two vehicles than you might prefer, I'd still rather be in that position than the position of not having either one of them.
Exactly. Yes, for sure.
So, I mean, that's the kind of, like I said, natural end. I mean, building cars is an expensive undertaking, and sports cars even more so because they don't sell in the volume that something like a, you know, Camry or a 3 Series sells in. So it's expensive to do. If they can say, sort of pool their resources and come up with something that's distinctive, and the way they've sort of kept the two cars a little bit different, it works for everyone, especially us consumers who will actually buy them. So,
right. And, you know, in addition to the collaboration between BMW and Toyota, they also, you know, went to Magna to actually do assembly. Both the BMW and the Toyota are built at Magna Steyr in Graz, Austria. And Magna, you know, specializes in doing lower volume contract production work.
Graz, that's the old G-Wagen plant, isn't it? That's where the, yep. Look at all that history.
Yeah.
And Vanagon's? I think Vanagon's came out of the same
plant. Lots of stuff has come out of there over the years.
That's a great factory.
Graz also builds the Magna plant there builds the Jaguar I-Pace.
Are they still doing Porsche?
Not anymore.
Okay.
Porsche's insourced those now. But they built the first generation BMW X3 there. They build the BMW, or the Mini Countryman is built there. They have built cars for Chrysler for the European market. They used to build Grand Cherokees and Caravans.
I was going to say Caravans, right? The diesel Caravans came out of there.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Inside baseball. those are the kind of details that are fun, though. So, all right. Are we good with the Supra?
Yep.
All right.
I'm good with it. I'll take one.
I mean, it's that or the Atlas Cross Sport with navigation that doesn't even understand you. So,
yeah, I mean, when you're in a Supra, who cares if the system doesn't understand you? Right? You just drive anyway.
Get me lost, please.
Go wherever the road takes you.
Right. Well, you wind up in Canada if you're not careful.
I know. I'm so demanding that I want it to take me to the post office. I mean, I got to get over that.
You've only been in Greenwich for how long? You should know where it is. All right, so I had a couple of things. I've spent less time in the 2021 Cadillac CT5. So I'll start with that and just briefly say this is the best Cadillac I've ever driven. It's a really good car. I think it's the 350T, I think, is the power level or whatever. It's got the V6.
The 2-liter?
No, this is the V6. So it's, what is it, a 3-liter?
It's a 3-liter, it's a twin turbo V6, right? So yeah, so it's a 3-liter. So I think that's a 550.
Oh, maybe it's 550 and I just glanced it out the window. quickly. Either way, there's lots of power. It doesn't want for power. It's not as quite as powerful as like the old CTSV was, but it's a little bit more responsible in that sense.
Well, the Blackwing's coming for that.
That's true. But it's really, really well tuned. I was telling somebody the other day, it's the best 3 series they've ever made. And what? No, I mean, it's a good way. They've spent so long chasing those cars, right? The 3 series and the 5 series. And they're making cars that dynamically probably actually could run neck and neck. The problem is really like the market just doesn't care anymore. They've got to focus more on their crossovers and SUVs, which are also good. But what I liked about the CT, 5 is that it doesn't have the NVH troubles that you find in the smaller crossovers, like the XT4, which is really fun to drive, but it feels a little bit too edgy for, I think, that the buyer.
Yeah, it needs some insulation.
Yeah. So the CT5, at least in this trim, there's definitely some engine burble, and I go back and forth. It sounds good when you are working it hard. Other times, I just really want it to shut up. So it kind of has that sort of like dual personality like the VQ V6 does in some cars, where it's great when you are making it do its thing, and otherwise it's just a little too loud and doesn't sound quite as graceful as like that BMW inline 6 would sound. Mm. It doesn't sound bad, but it's just... and it's not like the noise and vibration, the vibration and harshness, totally fine, totally under control. It's the noise part that, it was a little bit taken aback by. We'll see how I do with it for the rest of the week. But,
when you think about like I was just thinking about the Aston Martin that I had driven, like, and that's a big engine, but there, you do want it to still be elegant, like that gracefulness of like when you're sitting there, when you're not using the engine, it still needs to feel good. It needs to have a resonance to it and not be like, okay, enough, you know?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, I guess, is like, it's not just the sound, it's the quality of the sound.
And, oh, for sure.
You know, they have cylinder deactivation too, which messes with the rhythm of the pulses. So that's something that they're going to have to tune for, you know, sonically. I understand the challenges, and like, that's such a small thing to really be carping about. So, that's more of a personal observation. It does not mar the experience. It's a really good looking car. It's very comfortable. The infotainment is really well done and good to use.
Yay!
You know, there's a couple of knobs. There's one for tuning and one for volume, which is nice. And
there's actually 3 volume knobs.
Oh, there's 3. Oh,
yeah. There's one that's up on the just below the touchscreen.
Yep.
There's one that's down on the console next to the large controller, and then you've got the controller, the volume controller on the steering wheel.
On the steering wheel spoke. Yeah. And that large control knob is nice too. It like, you know, their materials and color folks, or whatever the division is called at GM, the folks that pick the
color
things
and trim.
Touch, yeah. The stuff you touch feels good, and it feels, and that's important in a Cadillac, especially, you know, you don't want to necessarily be grabbing the same dials as you are in a cruise. And this stuff feels special enough, at least, especially that large controller knob, and it's intuitive to use. So I was impressed with that. I liked the just sort of getting in and customizing it to my preferences was easy. I didn't swear at it much. So all of those things are good. And I'll have to spend a little bit more time with it. the car I spent the most time this week with was the 2021 Subaru Crosstrek Sport. And so, I mean, we've talked about the Crosstrek before. It's been around a while. So we know kind of the charms that it has. The Sport is a new model. It has a different look. The Crosstrek has gotten its mid-cycle refresh, so the nose is a little different. And the Sport has some different seat trim. I forget exactly what it's called off the top of my head, but it's not leather. It's not, you know, vinyl. It's a special kind of...
Oh, it's their vegan option.
Yeah, it's got the vegan seats.
Yes, the vegan seats.
And it's, you know, it has all those Subaru charms. And so what really struck me was sometimes, you know, when you hit your early 40s, you struggle with like feeling anything because you've spent so many years just having steely resolve. And so you have to do things that are mildly irresponsible to have any emotion at all, like drive in torrential downpours at night.
So
I know this is a sad little tale, right? Like, I just don't.
What our Patreon is. So many things to say.
Go ahead, Rebecca. I just want to say one quick thing for those of you listening to this. Keep in mind that Dan is by a pretty good margin the youngest of the three of us.
I'm 43. Yes, he is. I just turned 43. Okay. And
wait, when was your birthday? Did we miss your birthday?
It was in November. Yeah. I'm a Scorpio. Which I'm sure is not a shock to anybody. But you know, you just like you spend your 20s getting established. You spend your 30s just freaking surviving. And then like you look up and you're like, "Oh my god. I don't have it's almost like an addict, right? Like it just takes more to get that zip. This sounds dark and it's not what I mean. All I'm trying to say is that sometimes you like do things like drive in the worst weather. Like I love driving in snow. Why? Because like it's not because it's like an adrenaline thing like surfing or something would be. It's more of like it's a mastery thing. Like a musician playing for a crowd, which we can't do right now. but you get to go there and you're working your muscle memory. And so you need a car that's going to support that. And so here's where I'm bringing it full circle to the Subaru. The Crosstrek is a really good partner for any of those like inclement weather hijinks that you want to do. Cause I tend to like cars that are a little evil handling. And the reason why is because they make you concentrate. It kind of
requires some degree of skill and precision to
and engagement.
To keep it in control.
And that's why people like motorcycles, which I will certainly perish if I do that. So I will keep it on four wheels. But you know, the Subaru itself is just a solid platform. It's not evil handling, and it's just really stable and steady, and just a friendly car to drive. You know, I'm still not a huge fan of their Starlink or infotainment, but it's better here than it is in something like the Legacy, probably because the Crosstrek hasn't been updated yet. So I expect that it'll get that newer Subaru system at some point, and I'll complain more. But this current system is pretty good, and you know, it's a handy hatchback. It's a good size. It's pretty roomy, front and back seats. We took it to get the Christmas tree, so that was fun, because it has integral. Roof rails, and you know, Subaru has a lot of clever options for that lifestyle buyer. You know, it's a brand that people with dogs love because they've thoughtfully created options for you where you can get the dog cage, you can get the ramps for the dogs to get in the car. It is a go anywhere, do anything car that's not necessarily an SUV. So it's a friendly car for my dark little late night experts in the rain. We had torrential downpours here last week, and it was nice and gloomy, and I enjoyed it. So,
the phrase that I like to use for what Dan was just describing was "old enough to know better, young enough not to care."
Right. The only thing you have to watch out for is when it's windy, like it was. You know, it's like, is a tree branch going to fall on me? Because you know, they're heavier than they look.
Yeah, we've had some bad storms.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Dan, that's funny.
So yeah, sorry. didn't mean to bring Eeyore into the podcast. All right.
Especially Subaru, like the brand of love.
Well, I did. I loved driving the car in shitty weather. It was nice. It was fun. I didn't want to like stop. So, you know, it's one of those things like I remember doing this, like just like especially coming home or like going home from college on winter break or driving back to school once winter break was over, you know, I'm in New England. I went to school north of where I grew up. So I would invariably be driving into, you know, worse weather. And, usually I would leave late, so I'd be driving like at night on the highway. And so you just, you know, you got to take it easy when it's snowing, and you just, so you're just moving along at like 40 miles an hour. It's plowed enough for you to just do that. And you just relax, you know, you turn the seat heaters on, you play around with AM.
James Taylor.
No. What I would do to keep myself awake is I would just see like, how far away can I pick up on AM? Cause AM at night skips across the ionosphere. So you could easily in New England pick up Quebec. And then, you know, nice. Try to like translate the French, which they speak way too fast to make it work. So that's other people do fun things. These are the things I do for fun. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I feel like that's a real, like, this is a plea for listener feedback. You tell us what kind of weird crap you do for fun. Maybe I'll find new hobbies.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
2 days ago, Hyundai announced their new dedicated electric vehicle platform. And this is the first one they've ever done that is purely for battery electric vehicles. When they did the first generation Ioniq and Niro a few years back, that one was an electrified platform. And they had hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and battery electric variants of that, of those two vehicles. This time around, they've developed a completely battery electric only architecture that is going to be used. Their plan was 23 battery electric models between now and 2025 across all their brands, Hyundai, Kia, Genesis, and also this is the platform they're going to use for the robotaxi they're developing with Motional, which is their joint venture for automated vehicles with Aptiv. The first two models off of this, what they're calling EGMP, their electric global modular platform, are going to be the Ioniq 5, which is a compact midsize crossover. So, you know, roughly RAV4, Tucson size. And then there's going to be a Kia as well, which they haven't given any details on, but I think it's fairly reasonable to assume that it is going to be a replacement for the Niro that is based on the Habanero concept we saw last in 2019 at the New York Auto Show, and which was a really cool looking compact crossover concept that was all electric. And you know, I think it'd be if they build something that looks like that, you know, I think it'd be really cool for the Kia brand. But there's some interesting stuff they're doing with this one. You know, it's like everybody else. It's not a pure skateboard chassis like what you see from Rivian and some other companies, because you know the suspension and everything is not. It's not a rolling chassis with the suspension and motors and everything. It's the battery pack and everything is still tied to a unibody structure, but it's one that's designed specifically to be an EV. You know, they can scale the battery pack up and down, put more modules in it. It's a standard module format. They can put more or less depending on the application and, you know, the price point and performance that they need. Base rear wheel drive. So this is actually a lot like the VW MEB architecture. So the base configuration is rear motor, rear wheel drive, and then optional front dual motor, all wheel drive. Interestingly, it's an 800 volt architecture, so it's going to support 350 kilowatt charging. They say, you know, it'll charge up to 80% in about 18 minutes, 350 kilowatts. It'll, in 5 minutes, you can add 60 miles to it. So, you know, it should be a very practical vehicle for road trips.
That's a fantastic charging time because,
yeah.
I mean, then you can conquer a lot of the infrastructure issues that we face today with longer mm-hmm. charging times.
And they put, you know, a lot of emphasis on efficiency with this thing. So they're saying that the top range is going to be a little over 300 miles. So, you know, they're not trying to go down this 500 mile range route like Tesla and Lucid, but you know, I think their philosophy, you know, when they did the first generation Ioniq Electric, you know, they talked a lot about focusing on efficiency as well, which is why they limited the range, you know, to keep a smaller, lighter battery pack, which while, you know, it limited the range to about 125, 130 miles, it was a lot more efficient. It was also more cost effective. And I think that's what they're trying to do here is find a good balance of enough range and, you know, a lot of efficiency. So you get plenty of range, you know, from the minimal amount of battery pack possible. They're also, and so part of that, they're using silicon carbide power electronics, which so far Tesla was the first manufacturer to do that. And Hyundai is going to be the first mainstream incumbent manufacturer to do that.
What does that mean?
So the power electronics, that's your inverter. So your battery stores electricity in direct current. It puts out direct current. The motors are alternating current, which are more efficient. Okay. So that's like what comes out of your outlet. That's what comes from the grid is alternating current.
Okay.
And so the power electronics module switches back and forth between AC and DC. And there's always some losses associated with that conversion, that power conversion between AC and DC. Almost all EVs today, except for Teslas, use silicon switches in the power electronics, just pure silicon. What Tesla did was they went to something called silicon carbide, which is more efficient, and it can give you about 3 to 5% more range.
So yeah, but why is it pack size. Why is it more efficient? Can it handle more heat, or is it?
There's less heat generated.
Yeah.
So less of the power that you put through it is converted into heat.
I see. So the power goes in and out versus heats it up.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yep. And then one other interesting tidbit about this thing is it's got bidirectional charging capability, which means that you'll be able to plug stuff into it and get power out of it, get up to 3.5 kilowatts out of it. So if you have a power outage at your house, you could plug into your car and, you know, power your refrigerator or your microwave or your various other stuff off your car.
I love that. I think that's super cool. It's we've talked about this before. The challenge of the EV is to explain or to justify to people why this is a better solution than an internal combustion engine. And we as an industry have not done a good job of that. But, you know, the idea that this has 310 miles of range, that you can charge it up, you know, and sort of, you know, spot charge, if you will, getting, you know, 60 more miles, quickly. All of that makes it a more traditional ownership experience, which is what we have to try and work towards in order to facilitate deployment of these vehicles. Because right now, people say the internal combustion engine it's familiar. It's working perfectly adequately. We're more fuel efficient than we've ever been. And people don't see why they should have to why they should want to change over to an EV. You know, in their minds, it saves the environment, but then there's other aspects to it. Maybe it doesn't save the environment if you're producing dirty electricity. Or in California, where they're turning off electricity during, you know, fires or to prevent fires and such. So there's a lot of challenges here, but I think that this is a good combination of a very suitable range. Most cars have a gas tank range of 300 miles, and it's about, you know, a little bit longer than a trip to a gas station, but not that much. You know, if you can completely recharge us to 80% in, what was it, in 18 minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, maybe you buy a scratch off lottery ticket and, you know, sit there and do that while you're at a convenience station.
Have you ever been behind those guys buying all the scratch tickets? My God.
You know, but I mean, 18 minutes is not very long, especially if you're on your phone. So I think that this is, you know, I love that combination. I'd rather, you know, 500 miles is great. That's an amazing range, but we've lived for decades with 300 miles being sort of the standard. The thing that I've always said for years while I've been working on EVs is the charging. If we get the charging infrastructure, if we get the charging times down to as if you were going to the gas station, that's one of the biggest barriers.
And that's, you know, I think that's one of the interesting choices that Hyundai's made, is to make the 800 volt architecture as the standard setup for this platform. So GM with its Ultium system, they're going to have a couple of different variants. You know, they're going to have vehicles that have a 400 volt system and some that have 800 volts. So the bigger vehicles like the Hummers and the trucks and so on, they're going to have 800 volt systems in them. But, you know, vehicles like the Cadillac Lyriq are going to have 400 volts. So they're going to be limited to about 150 kilowatt charging, which is less than half of what the 800 volt systems will do. And the fact that Hyundai has chosen to do that as the baseline across all the variants, I think is an interesting choice. You know, so they're trying to make it as convenient as possible.
What's the, sort of like, what's the price range that they're looking to cover with these?
They have not said what the, you know, I mean, next sometime, well, probably in the spring or so, we'll see the reveal of the Ioniq 5, that's when we'll have a better idea. My guess is that they're probably going to aim for a starting price in the mid 30s.
That's not really that expensive.
No.
You know?
Yeah, and at least for a time, you know, Hyundai is still going to be eligible for, you know, the $7,500 federal tax credit and whatever state credits are available. You know, they still are, they're not at their 200,000 limit yet. So that'll help.
Well, and depends on what gas prices do as well, whether it makes sense, you know. If gas prices go up, this is going to be a better deal in, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hyundai is aiming to be selling a million EVs a year by 2025. That's their target.
That's super ambitious.
That's 48 months away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, okay. That's the same target that GM has. Actually, Hyundai's target is a million EVs a year globally in 2025. GM a couple weeks ago said they're aiming for a million a year in the U.S.
Wow.
By 2025?
I mean, globally, a million is doable out of 90 million cars that are sold. So that's possible for Hyundai to do. In the States here, again, you know, a lot, it depends. There's a lot of changes demographically that are going on in the next 5 years.
Well, yeah,
and, but, you know, we're going to start seeing EVs coming into a lot of new market segments where they've never been before as well.
Right.
But a million a year, even with like November's sales rate, which was like 15 something million. So that's like what, 15% of the market by 2025?
Actually, I think the GM target was a million a year globally. It wasn't just for North America. Yeah. So it's going to be split mainly between the U.S. and China. So probably half a million here.
I mean, that's relatively easy to do with China with the regulations that they have in place. And it's a 20 million, 22 million market every 24. Year. 24 now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you think, you know, it wasn't really that long ago when the US was the number one market, but in China, because of regulations and because of the mandates that they have there, a million EVs is, or even half a million is definitely doable.
Well, by 2023, GM is going to have three assembly plants producing EVs exclusively: the Orion, Michigan plant, the Detroit Hamtramck plant and the Spring Hill, Tennessee plant are all going to be exclusively building electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles. So, you know, at, you know, 250,000 a piece, you know, that's capacity for, you know, 750,000 EVs a year just from those three plants.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, you know, when a lot of the work that I did in Saudis in focused on who bought EVs and why. But at that time, we were really limited to just the Nissan Leaf and the Tesla Model S. And so now, as you mentioned, the proliferation of new product into different segments that will appease a lot of different groups. I mean, I think that there's, again, if we can normalize the look of the vehicle and the ownership experience, there's certainly from a driving standpoint, these are very engaging vehicles. You know, I didn't love the Ioniq when I had it, but there's still, you know, but I did love the Kona. So I think that there's opportunity there to really get a new audience for EVs, and demographically there are a lot of changes coming. A lot of younger buyers are going to be coming into in 5 years time. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity here.
Yeah,
absolutely. And in the commercial space also, you know, for Hyundai and Kia, I mean, they have a lot of opportunity in the commercial space to get EVs. And when we talk about that engine noise, my gosh, you can hear a diesel truck coming a mile away, right? How nice is it to not have that in an EV?
Yeah, or just be choking on the exhaust.
Well, the drivers actually prefer EVs in their commercial vans, you know, like the Sprinter types, because it is quiet and they're not surrounded by diesel fuels.
While we're still on EVs, you know, we've got a couple other things. Cadillac has been offering $500,000 or more buyouts to dealers that don't want to invest in EV support. And, you know, Cadillac's got a stated goal of basically being pretty much all EV by the end of this decade.
So does that mean that they're like, if you don't want to support EVs, they're buying you out, like, and you are no longer a Cadillac franchise dealer?
So they'll say, if you don't want to sell EVs, support EVs, we don't want you to sell Cadillacs anymore. And here's a check. Go away. Go sell something else.
But it's just 500 grand?
500,000 and up. I think it'll vary depending on the dealer. But my guess is, you know, what we're likely to see is, you know, smaller dealers, you know, getting 500,000, you know, those that don't want to invest a couple hundred thousand dollars in, you know, the parts and the equipment that's needed and chargers and, you know, all the other stuff they need to support EVs and training for their staff. You know, the big dealers, the big Cadillac dealers, you know, if one of them, you know, wanted to not sell EVs, you know, I'm sure that GM would offer them more money, but, you know, all they're buying back is the franchise, not the whole store.
These are people that geographically will probably see some differences as well, you know, in people that take them up on this offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, probably be some dealers, you know, like in the more rural areas, you know, in the Midwest and some places like that, you know, the bigger dealers in the urban areas, you know, they're going to sell EVs because they're going to have customers in those markets that want them. You know, they're going to want cars like the Lyriq and the Celestiq and whatever else comes up. Another related thing with GM as well is with the Hummer coming next year. You know, there's been some reports about how GM is handling that with their dealers. Apparently, what GM has been telling their dealers, their GMC dealers, is the whole purchase process with the Hummer EV is going to be handled online, and basically the dealers are going to take care of final delivery and service and support. Customers buying the Hummer EV will do it online. You know, they'll take care of all the financing and stuff online, and you know, then GM will assign the delivery to a dealer, and you know, they'll handle that. But the dealers won't be getting any inventory of Hummers.
So, you know, one thing on the Cadillac dealer issue, isn't an EV, it doesn't require as much service. So they potentially are not going to be making as much money on servicing also.
Yeah, that is. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why, especially smaller dealers might be reluctant to make the investment that's required.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, importantly, though, there's that tension, right, between the manufacturer, the main brand, and the small dealers. And I guess I want to make sure that we're not making it sound like these dealers are jerks. It's, they got businesses to run.
There is investment
to make.
For some dealers, you know, it absolutely doesn't make economic sense to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in, you know, in spare parts inventory and training and equipment and chargers if they know that they're probably not going to sell very many, if any, of those vehicles.
So in this, I'm reading in one of the articles about this, it says, according to the latest report, even a buyout offer of $300,000 can equal 10 years worth of new Cadillac vehicle sales for some dealers. $300,000? Are they talking about profit there? What they're making in profit?
Margins.
Even a buyout offer of $300,000 can equal 10 years worth of new Cadillac vehicle sales for some dealers.
It's probably profit. It may be that some small dealers, you know, that maybe aren't exclusive Cadillac stores, you know, if they're selling GMC
or maybe,
you know, just some other non-GM brand,
right.
Cadillac, that they, you know, they may not see the justification in spending that money on Cadillac EVs.
No, I mean, if you're not going to buy a Cadillac EV, how about you come over here and we'll put you into a nice, nice Tahoe for a more profit. Or how about an HD pickup truck? $100,000 crew cab pickup.
Well, I suspect Cadillac dealers that are selling other GM brands are probably not gonna be the ones that don't want to make the investment, because GM's doing this across all four brands. So there's gonna be, you know, a lot of GM EVs coming, as we mentioned. And those dealers, you know, they're going to spend the money. They're going to make the investment because they're not going to have any choice.
For the more mass market brands, the hump is going to be a little easier to get over. My guess is that anytime they make a big shift like this, like they did with Hummer and Saab, they put those dealerships together. They had particular architects, particular architecture for the dealerships that the dealers had to front the money for, and or had to at least secure the loans with their own collateral. So it was, you know, there's a big investment on the dealer side too. And if you're rolling it out with Cadillac, they want, you know, that brand experience to be premium versus Chevy, which they still want a good brand experience, but different and probably for less money.
And before we leave EVs, I just want to mention, speaking of EVs with Rivian, Laura Schwab, went from being the president of Aston Martin of the Americas to being the VP of sales and marketing for Rivian, the first person in that position as they go to launch. So that will be an interesting development to watch.
Is she a friend of yours? Can she get us some Rivians?
She could probably get us some Rivians.
Let's get some Rivians.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be, you know, we're coming to the time where some of these brands, Rivian among them, the Fisker Ocean, you know, we're starting to see these come to fruition. So it's an exciting time.
Well, the Fisker Ocean, it's funny. We mentioned Magna earlier. I think Magna's building that.
Magna's building the Fisker Ocean in Graz as well.
This dovetails nicely with EVs, and we don't need to belabor the point too much, but there's more and more internal combustion engine bans. And like the more I hear it reported, the more I get a little frustrated at the tone, because like you can keep your car. It's not like they're going away. It's that they want to stop the sale of new ones, which,
right.
You're shaping behavior through you know, regulation and policy. And, you know, I know we were talking about this before we started recording, so I know you two have thoughts about it, but, like, I don't know of any other way to actually accelerate EV adoption than to take, you know, internal combustion engines off the retail shelves. And
I do. You normalize the ownership experience of EVs.
Well, I think they're working.
It would be a natural progression. The problem is it's not fast enough for a lot of people, but it's not fast enough because there hasn't been the right product. Now we have the right technology. We have the products. We've got to get that ownership experience. And frankly, we still have a lot of challenges with the electrical grid.
Yeah, that's true. I think the infrastructure is lagging still.
We haven't really totally solved that issue. By any stretch. Look at the blackouts in California right now. I mean, it's like we can't, it's like converting everything over and not having a fuel source.
Yeah. And I mean, for what it's worth, you know, most of the big utilities are actively working on this. You know, they're working on, you know, what do they need to do to modernize their grid infrastructure to support EVs, because they actually do want more EVs on the road, because, you know, that's a market for their product, which is electricity. You know, so they want EVs out there, but, you know, they do need to make some changes, you know, updates in their grid. And, you know, they need to do things like, you know, have managed charging, you know, so that they can, they can remotely manage, you know, how much energy is going into EVs at various times of the day. Because ideally what you want, you know, as a grid operator, as a utility, is, you know, you want to have a constant flow of electricity. You don't want it cycling up and down too much. And so, you know, if you can manage that charging process better, you know, and you, if you have EVs out there that you can manage, you know, when they're drawing from the grid, and also, you know, with things like bidirectional charging, when, you know, if you can draw a bit of power out of those vehicles and use those vehicles that are plugged in as a buffer to help, you know, shave some of the peak loads off of, you know, when you've got high load on the grid, you know, so you don't have to ramp up another power plant to generate more power. If you can draw a bit of power from some of the vehicles that are out there, those are the sorts of things that they're working on now. And by the time we get to the end of the decade, you know, when we're starting to look at some of these bans on sales of new internal combustion engines, you know, I think they'll have a lot of those issues sorted out. The other thing is, you know, Dan, you mentioned, you know, those ICEs that are out there today are not going anywhere. Yeah, I mean, we've got 290 million registered vehicles in the United States alone.
That's almost,
you know,
as many.
Almost
people.
All of which, you know, like all but about a million of which are internal combustion engines.
Yeah,
you know, those things are not going away. You know, the average age of vehicles on the road today is 12 years now.
Right.
And, you know, so it's going to take decades before all of those vehicles are gone.
Well, and we honestly, we shouldn't want them to go away instantly. We should want to get as much use out of them as feasible, because of the amount of energy and raw materials it took to make them.
To build them.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the emissions are an issue, and at a certain point, you know, you're going to be doing, you know, the environmental harm that you're doing from running it versus, you know, sort of getting all of that sort of return on the initial investment of energy and materials. You know, those two lines cross, and then you start just actively polluting a little bit more. I'm trying to wrap my head around that, but they're going to coexist. And, you know, we're seeing energy shift too. Now renewables like wind and solar are some of the cheapest energy out there. And the big problem with that is, yeah, especially like solar, the sun needs to shine. But if you have a grid with storage, which, you know, that's where the grid is going, it smooths out those peaks and valleys. And so if everybody's car can act as a little bit of storage, and, you know, if they rely on your car heavily, you get a check. It's almost like if you have solar on your house, right? Like you do, Rebecca. Do you ever get a check from the?
I don't actually, sadly. But I think that, I mean, my concern though is if we, and I could be completely not understanding this, but so if we're looking at cars as potential sources, like when they're plugged in and maybe it powers your house, you know, like mine could do or something. But then that also means having a charger at in your home,
right,
which is different than, and one of the barriers, because when we think about multi-unit dwellings, and again, different, you know, there's not anybody that has a gas station at their house anymore. And so, you know, the farm next to me used to have, they literally used to have a gas station.
Well, you get the farm diesel too, that had the red dye in it that, you know, if you got busted on the road, you didn't pay road tax. So yeah.
But I think that, you know, we have to be, when we're creating this infrastructure, we have to think as far down the road as possible. And, you know, like I had mentioned before, Volkswagen investing in these cool, and I never described them properly, but like the little robot guys that come to your car and, you know,
mobile chargers,
thank you. And they'll charge your car and then they go back to their little station, and you don't need designated parking and you don't need the tower of infrastructure and such, or the, you know, the actual charger, individual chargers there. So I want to make sure that we are thinking as far into the future as possible when it comes to how we charge these vehicles. But some of these projects are going to take 10, 12, 10, 15, 20 years beyond what, you know, we're asking manufacturers to do right now. Hey, we, you know, we're banning cars. Oh, we don't have any way of charging them, but we're banning them. So I think that there's a balance there that we have to make sure that people are working in tandem and these industries are working in tandem. You know, Saudi Aramco they have six different engine development labs around the world, because their number one concern is that we don't run out of oil, because if they run out of oil, they're in trouble. So they want to make the most efficient engines possible.
But also, so the sun really, like, isn't Saudi Arabia kind of sunny? Wouldn't solar be good there?
You would think.
Yeah.
However, what happens to the solar panels? There's a lot of sand.
Oh, that's
and
true.
And because there's limited water, where in the desert, obviously, it's hard to clean them. So there was a solar panel, one of the largest in the Middle East, and they actually said, you know, the capacity, the utilization was really poor, and so some bright crew got a bunch of rags and wiped the sand away and scratched all the panels, and the utilization was halved from what it was. So it went from being like 70 down to 30 because all the panels were scratched.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So it seems obvious, but the reality also is that it's so hot. So the compound that I lived on, we had a huge solar grid. But the problem was that the houses that they build are huge as well and not particularly well insulated. So even though we were actually LEED certified in the building that I worked in was highly energy efficient, the environment, the climate just is really difficult to try and manage the sand on the solar panels.
Huh.
Yeah. It's always something.
Like as with everything, it's not as simple as it seems at first. Or it's simple, but it's not easy. You know, those are two distinct things.
Yes.
And our grid and our energy utilities here have a lot of issues. Like, you know, in California in particular, like I think there's a lot of under maintained systems to begin with, and just adding the demands of EVs to it is going to show even more cracks. We can get a handle on that. We just have to commit to it.
And yeah, I mean, that's why we're seeing a lot of growth in what's known as DER, distributed energy resources. You know, so moving more and more away from centralized generation and then distribution through the grid, you know, where you have a bunch of big power plants, you know, moving to smaller generation facilities, you know, solar, residential solar on buildings and warehouses and wind and, you know, all this stuff, you know, so just having it a more distributed system that should also be more resilient.
Yeah. And hydro too, right? Because mm-hmm. Hydro is pretty good.
Yeah, hydro is like the original renewable energy source.
Yeah, and so we just went through this in New England. They want to build, you know, there was a deal with Hydro-Québec in Massachusetts. And the way they were going to get the power here was they were going to hack a giant high tension transmission line through the White Mountain National Forest.
And they How'd that go?
Like, no, that's not happening. So there's, you know, our grid is, you know, transmission capacity is limited too. And it's just like in New England, where like natural gas transmission capacity is limited. So energy, it's a really interesting sort of sidebar to automobiles, because all of our cars take energy. If we go EV, they're kind of fuel agnostic. That's cool. But the only fuel that really has the infrastructure that makes life as pleasant as it currently is petroleum. And so how do we make it as easy or close to as easy with alternatives? And we're getting there with EVs. You know, the tech has to catch up too. So the faster they can charge, the more attractive it's going to be to get them off the road, get gas cars off the road. So,
well, before gas cars die, there's something else that's dying, Dan.
Yes, we're all dying a little bit every day.
So is the Volkswagen
Passat. The Passat it's named after a wind, right? And it's blowing away. It's like it's like sands through the. Sands through the hourglass.
You are dark tonight, big guy.
I mean, that's Days of Our Lives, isn't it? Like sands through the hourglass. These are the days of our lives. Anyway, we don't need to belabor this either. The Passat is dying because people aren't buying it because they're buying crossovers like that Atlas, Cross Sport and the Atlas.
Exactly.
And, you know, big sedans are one of the casualties of our buying habits shifting. So it kind of sucks a little bit because, you know, Passat goes, but we had the first Passat was the Dasher and then the Quantum. And then they decided to actually call it the Passat. So it's a thing to lose. Kind of sucks. Are you guys as verklempt as I am about it?
No.
Nobody cares.
The current, I mean, we owned a Passat for, almost 9 years. We had a 2000 Passat wagon, which was a great car to drive and a terrible car to own. But you know, my wife, like, when it wasn't in the shop, my wife loved that car.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And you know, that was like the last generation of great Passat in North America. And then, you know, after that one went away, we got one that was made more amenable to the U.S. market.
Yeah, it was a great Impala.
That sounds like a country song. What is it? I'm a bad boy, but a good man. Yeah.
You know, the current generation Passat is fine, but it's nothing special.
It's a Lumina. It's or an Impala. Yeah. It's
just, it's not the Lumina. That bad. Come on.
It's fine. It's a big.
It's a Camry.
Yeah.
It's a German-designed, American-built Camry.
It's fine. You know, it's like, I think it's probably actually better owner experience.
I'm sure it absolutely is.
It's nowhere near the, like, so you had it at the Zenith, the PX era, with like, that was like when you could get the W8 and the bonkers. I mean,
the B4 platform. So it was the same architecture as, it was basically an Audi A4.
Right, yeah.
That was, you know, about 10 grand cheaper. You know, but didn't feel 10 grand cheaper.
Right.
Know, that was badges on it, but
that was the sort of, that was the peak of Volkswagen. Everything was just fantastic then. And completely unreliable. and so the newer ones are better. The new Jetta, the Jetta's been that way since what, like 2010, 2011 too. It got,
something like that. Yeah.
Bigger and cheaper and probably, less exotic in terms of the engineering, but, you know, again, just like a better sort of straightforward car, but that's not what people are buying. So it makes sense for it to just die. And it's not the rest of the world Passat anyway. It's our Passat. The Passat that the rest of the world gets isn't even the same car. So it makes sense for Volkswagen to say like, well, we're gonna tie off the bleeder here and just stop building this.
Well, and you know, the Chattanooga plant where they build it, you know, they also build the Atlas there. And they're going to be switching that plant, you know, switching that over to building the new ID4 and ID5 and other electric vehicles there. So that's another plant that's being converted to EV production.
Right. So it's just, you know, sometimes when you, when you've served your time, you just have to take a long walk in the woods.
Yep. All right.
Let's get some listener questions.
Yeah, some listener questions. And let's stick with VW for the first one.
Okay.
This is from Friedel and Koch. Greetings from Germany. Been listening to from the beginning. Was tipped off to the show by Casey Liss on ATP. Thanks, Casey. Just to check in, living in southern Germany, driving a 2019 VW Touran. So the Touran
is
MQB-based minivan based on the same on the Golf. It's basically a taller, longer Golf.
Those are cool. I want one.
Yeah. And also a smart cabriolet.
Those are also cool.
So the question, do you think the minivan and maybe the wagon too will be totally subsumed by SUVs and crossovers? I found that there are people that want to buy one, minivan that is, but there are so few left on the market, and that is nearly impossible. Maybe a chicken and egg problem? For my part, I'm hoping to still be able to buy one when it's time to replace the Touran, but maybe the ID Buzz will fill that role. So what do you guys think?
I'll let you go first, Rebecca.
go first. I've been talking a lot.
Okay. I think that vans like the Touran don't do well here in the U.S., but they are a really good match for other markets because they're compact and very functional. I think there's also a generation coming up that is going to rebel against the crossover, much as the generation before, you know, grew up in minivans and is buying anything but a minivan. And before that, the minivans sold because they weren't wagons. So everything is sort of cyclical. And each of those things that came before feels kind of exotic to generations to come after. You know, you get a little distance from it and it's different and it's neat. And so I'm sure that if there's enough buyers, they'll come back, even if the ones we have currently go out of production. Vans are a really good idea, and every now and then somebody reinvents one. You know, it's like all the tech bros out in Silicon Valley. You know, they want to disrupt everything, and then they wind up inventing the bus. same kind of thing. Like,
I mean, I think the number one distinction and the number one reason for purchase of a minivan is the sliding doors.
Sliding doors are great. Sliding doors are great.
They are great for little kids to get in and out of. It's ideal. And that's why I think that minivans will always, as long as there are families, there will be minivans because of the sliding door. If they do something silly, like for some reason, completely discontinue sliding doors, then you're just getting a crossover. And then that's defeating the whole purpose of getting a quote minivan. So I think it's like pickup trucks without the pickup bed. That's an SUV.
Right.
And so, you know, that the sliding doors, as long as minivans will exist as long as they have sliding doors.
Well, so, but like the Touran doesn't have, the Touran is more like a Mazda 5. Well, the Mazda 5 had a sliding door, didn't it?
Which is why we wouldn't consider it a minivan.
Yeah. That's true. This is like the C-Max or whatever it was called. I think it was the Galaxy it was based on, but just, you know, it's a tall, boxy, not hatchback. I don't know what to. And it's got four.
Well, I mean, doors. I'm looking at, you know, yeah, the
you're
ID4.
Right. The current generation Touran does not have sliding doors.
Yeah, and the ID4 doesn't either. So,
no, well, the ID4 is a crossover. You know, it's not even.
Oh, I'm sorry. Which one did he reference? The Buzz?
The Buzz. The ID Buzz.
Yes.
Does, or at least the concept had sliding doors.
Yes, had sliding doors.
The production one will.
Yes.
And that's the ID Buzz is scheduled for production launch in 2022. So that one is coming. That one. So, you know, that one should be around, you know, right about the time you want to be maybe looking at replacing the Touran. It probably will be a fair bit bigger than the Touran. Since it's ID, that means it's going to be electric, battery electric.
Yep.
They're going to exist.
Keep us posted.
They're going to be around.
Yeah. All right. Next one from Chris Meisenzahl. I've seen some sketchy reports of an imminent new Land Cruiser. Would you Would love to hear what you three know and your thoughts about Toyota in this segment. Thanks.
I know nothing.
I think that the issue, I mean, the current Land Cruiser is incredibly expensive for the market.
Yeah, I thought it was actually getting discontinued.
Right. So there's a discussion that it will not, the next generation will not come to the U.S. And I think a lot of it is pricing. That's just my first.
Well, I mean, you can get a Land Cruiser that's like $90,000 and it's doesn't feel like a Lexus. It's nice, but it's not that nice. You know, and it's serious hardware. It's the, you know, all three differentials lock, and it's legit an off-road vehicle that doesn't ever.
You know, the Land Cruiser, you know, the current generation Land Cruiser launched in 2007, so it's been around for a while. It's, you know, it's old.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there. In fact, I would be surprised if there's not a new Land Cruiser in development. You know, that's that will probably launch in the next 12 to 18 months. But you're right. Whether it gets sold here, who knows? You know, we might end up just with the Lexus LX version and not get the Toyota badged version of it.
I think that's the most likely scenario because the Lexus, I had it a couple of months ago, and the one that I had was $100,260, including destination. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Land Cruiser is not that far off from that number. And so I think that it's a pricing issue. That's the number one. And of course, just lack of demand, too.
Right.
I mean, people aren't going to use it like that.
You know, what might be interesting is if Toyota decides to do to take the Toyota version, the Land Cruiser, and maybe take it down market a bit more and, you know, try to compete with vehicles like the Bronco and the Wrangler.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Don't they have the 4Runner for
that? Right, I was going to say, I thought the 4Runner kind of is their bogey.
I just got a 4Runner today. I love it. It's so fun. It's so cool looking.
Yeah. And the problem that Toyota has, too, at that end of the market with the larger SUVs is in the U.S. they've got the Sequoia that fills probably 95% of the same role and is actually larger. It's not going to be as good off-road as the Land Cruiser.
The Land Cruiser's got that off-road capability
where
the Sequoia lacks. But
I think that the way we use cars here in the States, the Sequoia is a better match and it's cheaper. It's not
right. That's why I was thinking that, you know, you could potentially see them, you know, maybe take it down market more, and try to make it more of that pure off-roader.
I'd be fine with that
platform.
globally,
how big a market is there for that, you know, for that, you know, that segment?
Probably none.
Well, yeah, but I mean, think about, it's more the want than the actual. So people just want to be able to go off-road, but they don't actually do it. But, you know, the Land Cruiser is super popular in the Middle East and other parts, and where people do need that kind of traction. You do need that type of capability in the sand and where people go on a regular basis. So I think that there's demand for something like the Land Cruiser in other parts of the world, but maybe just not in the States.
Yeah. And that's fine. Like there's a lot of Toyotas we don't get that are actually kind of neat.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
So, all right, what's next? Any more questions?
Next up, this is from Steve Benoff. Love the show, never miss it. I bought a 2017 Genesis G80 new, and I love it. I call it a poor man's Mercedes. I love all the standard equipment, including the V6, all for a list price of $41,000. I paid $38,000. The 2020 G80 was under $43,000, but the 2021 G80 starts at over $48,000. When you include $400 for just about any paint choice, and if I want a V6, it's $10,000 more. Clearly, Genesis has a new demographic in mind. The considerable price increase can only work to my benefit in raising the value of my car, though I won't be selling it for many years. But if I were buying a new car today, I'd probably go for an Avalon, which can be had with a V6 for considerably less than the new G80. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, the extra $10,000 for the V6 is definitely not worth it in the G80. We just talked about having driven both of those vehicles recently, both those engines rather, in the G80 and the GV80. But I mean, yes, Hyundai is, Genesis is moving up brand with the Genesis brand. They're separating, they want more separation between Hyundai's pricing and Genesis, and more definition in what in Genesis as the luxury brand. I mean, look at what we just talked about with the Lexus and Toyota, right? There's very little price difference between the Toyota version and the Lexus version. And so the Toyota version, you know, there isn't the demand because the Lexus buyer is going to be more tolerant of that pricing. Genesis is trying to move up market and separate itself from Hyundai. But you know, the G80 that we both, Sam and I both had, is a really, really good car. For even for $48,000, it's still really good. Yeah, the pricing on the paint, I totally understand that, Steve. I respect that. But I don't, I mean, then the new Avalon is pretty good. I personally love the looks and the driving experience in the Genesis, the 2021 G80.
They're definitely, yeah, the Avalon and the Genesis are going to have different characters. But I think, too, in 2017, we didn't yet have the G70 that we've had to make room, Genesis has had to make room for at the bottom of their range. So that covers right. that price, that, you know, mid-30s to low 40s price is the G70. Now, I realize it's smaller and... So if you want a car the size of the G80, you're kind of stuck, unless you're, you know, you wait a little bit and buy one that's off lease or something, and you can still get the value out of it that way. But if you want it brand new, yeah, I guess the prices have increased a bit. You know, and there's nothing wrong with saying like that's too rich for my blood. What else is around? There's nothing wrong with the Avalon. I like it quite a bit. It's just, it's not the same kind of car. And the G80 has those rear wheel drive, sort of traditional big luxury sedan dynamics going on. And that may not actually be all that important to you. You know, so yeah, I mean, it's an interesting observation too, because typically I think of Genesis and I think like, well, you're getting all of the stuff that the German brands give you, but you are paying considerably less. And now as they sort of get established, that's gap is closing a bit.
Plus, Genesis doesn't have Entune. So, you know, I think that's worth an extra 10 grand.
That's true. After suffering with Entune, you might want to pay. Yeah. okay.
All right. Why don't we call it a night at that?
All right, good. Well, so thanks for listening. You know where to find us. We are at feedback@wheelbearings.media. And you can find all our new channels for the Patreon and other things. Patreon is patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. And you can find us on social, and we'll be around. Keep sending your questions in. We'll see everybody next time.
Thanks, bye. Everyone.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.